news networks were cancelling other programming and were heard saying, "This is the real X-Files." There was enormous excitement. This event beta tested the national security shadow government control on this issue and over the media. It was interesting to see how they would handle it. Well, word of this event got out. Ultimately, between the interviews on the BBC and the Voice of America and all the other media coverage, hundreds of millions heard about it. The National Press Club staff thought we had a multi-million dollar budget and a huge staff. But all we had was the incredible dedication of our volunteers. When they found out that there wasn't a single paid person there except this one temporary PR woman, they couldn't believe it. The general manager of the National Press Club said, "Well, this is the most organized event that's ever been here." They also told us that it was the best attended press event at the National Press Club since Ronald Reagan had been in the building. The media was allowed to cover a certain amount of this event, or it would have been too obvious of a cover-up. But then they took it off the airwaves very quickly. So, it went up on CNN Headline News briefly, and CNN International actually had a very significant amount of coverage in Europe. Pravda and the Chinese news agency also covered it. But what was interesting was to see the lack of follow-through with the big media organizations, such as the Wall Street Journal, who interviewed me, and the big news magazines and others. They would say, "This is really a significant event." And then later they would get back to me and they would say, "Well, they won't let us run with this story." Ira Rosen, executive producer of ABC News, had been a key investigator for Mike Wallace at 60 Minutes and had won an Emmy for his work. He had been involved for a year or so with what we were doing and had been at our home for meetings. He'd been through all the materials. We'd given him enormous amounts of documents, testimony, and information. He wanted to do a very strong primetime live and 2020 piece, if not a series, on this. But after this national press event, he called and said, "Well, it looks like I'm not going to be able to do this story." I asked, "Why not?" He says, "They won't let me put it on. They won't let me do this piece." I asked, "Who's they?" He said, "Well, Dr. Greer, you know who they are." He told my wife and me, while he was at our home having lunch, that he had credible information that they couldn't go with regarding shadowy FBI interests that had shot Martin Luther King. Rosen had been involved in getting to the bottom of that, but they also never ran that story. So it was interesting to see how ABC ultimately had to back off covering the UFO subject. There was enormous pressure brought to bear not to let this get too much traction. The covert controllers knew that if the major news groups started pulling this yarn and unraveling it, the whole cover-up would come undone. We have enough assets and enough information to unravel the whole matrix. And certainly, the interests that want to keep this secret know this and brought pressure to bear to kill the in-depth follow-up stories. Imagine what we could achieve if we had any real significant institutional support or funding. If we had had $5 or $10 million, we could have completely ended the secrecy. A lot of this now is in the hands of the public, the information is there. People can put the testimony on cable access channels or show it in their communities. And this is happening all over the world. The day after the National Press Club event, one of our military witnesses was outside the White House and had a disclosure project identification badge on. Andy Card, who is the chief of staff of the president, came out and saw it, and said, "Oh, the disclosure project. We've been watching this. Good luck with that." This disclosure military witness then gave Andy Card a briefing file, which Card then ride right into the White House. The Washington Times had a big half-page article about it, and that's the paper of record for the Republicans and certainly what they read at the White House. The afternoon of the press conference, we began meeting with various members of Congress. I personally gave Senator Ted Kennedy the whole briefing document. Congressman Kucinich, who is head of the Progressive Caucus in the Congress, invited us to his office for a sit-down briefing. There were 9 of us who arrived immediately after the Disclosure Project National Press Club event. He sat with all of us and asked each witness to share a very short vignette of what they knew about the UFO matter. After everyone had shared, he turned to me and looked me in the eyes and said, "I have to tell you that in all my years in Congress, I have never felt an energy and a spirit like I have today when you all walked through these doors." Then he said, "The fact that you are here tells me the time is short." He was the most perceptive government leader I have ever met, and certainly the most enlightened. There are many people in the Congress who know what we are doing and are following it closely. We met with numerous members of Congress that week. John Cypher, the actor who introduced me at the National Press Club, and Carol Rose Ine, met with Daniel Golden, who at the time was the head of NASA. Golden came to NASA from Science Applications International Corporation. An interesting pattern develops. We continue to have meetings periodically with members of Congress about this. Congressman Virgil Good, who is the congressman for my home district, was on the House National Security Committee, and met with me for an hour, privately. He said, "I have been reading about what you've been doing, for some time, a lot of us have." Then he said, "But, you know, there's another group that really runs the show. It's very shadowy, just as you've described. And we're, members of Congress, window dressing." He flat out told me, "Those of us in the Congress of the United States are window dressing." And I said, "Well, yes, sir, I know that. On the other hand, you have enough power to do something, if you collectively choose to do it." And we had a discussion about that. Towards the end of the meeting he said, "I really need to see the technologies. And that's what a lot of us are waiting for. What you need to do next is put together something that proves the technologies behind the phenomenon." I've heard this from a number of congressmen. Congressman Good and I also discussed the extent to which the media is corrupt and controlled. If anyone did try to step out on this matter, just as Congressman Sif had, he would be cut off, ridiculed, and attacked. So, it isn't that there are no people in the Congress who are supportive of disclosure. There really are. But they feel like they don't have the ability to do what they would like to, because of the structural obstacles that are in place to contain disclosure, the worst of which is the corruption and control of the mass media. The big media is completely corrupted, infiltrated by the worst elements of this control group and is no more free, here in the United States, than the Chinese news agency. In fact, the Chinese news agency and Pravda did a better job reporting what we're doing than the Washington Post, Newsweek, Time, etc. The only free press is the insignificant press. And this is something people never think about. People say, "Well, you can say anything." I say, "Yes, you can put it on the internet, where it gets ignored and lost in all the digital flotsam, or you can put it in some insignificant journal. But when you're talking about the big media, big Hollywood, big publishing, big newspapers, big electronic media and TV, they are completely corrupted and controlled by shills for the secret government. The large media empires have been horizontally and vertically integrated into the corporate transnational shadow entity that maintains secrecy. The fox is guarding the henhouse." Bob Schwartz, who had been on the board of Time, Life, flat out said that the media have become scribes sitting at the right hand of the king, taking dictation. He said this to me in the early 90s, in New York. "So we have no fourth estate that's meaningful. The checks and balances that the founding fathers of America envisioned have been gone for decades. A few prestigious, well-placed people are also used to control the spin of this information." One of the people YH introduced me to after the 2001 disclosure event in San Francisco was a man who is a very wealthy European financier and hotelier. He had just been at the Bohemian Grove, a retreat in California near the Russian River where the world power elites gather for meetings and recreation, with about 2,500 of the world's most prominent people. This meeting was happening at the same time the Disclosure Project was being rolled out, with a multi-city tour. This man told us very influential people were asking about the Disclosure Project at this Bohemian Grove gathering. To quell this interest, The control group got a prestigious member of the gathering to go on stage and tell everyone that he had been on the inside of these investigations for the government, and that there was nothing to it. It was, in fact, all swamp gas and misapprehension of explainable meteorites and natural phenomena. And this wealthy man who had attended the meeting asked me, "Why would they have some, one of that stature addresses at the same time you're having this meeting with 1,000 people in San Francisco?" I said, "Because they operate by having a few respectable people in every organization function as vectors of disinformation, whether it's the Bilderbergers or CFR or the Trilateral Commission or the Senate or the Vatican. Most of the people involved with these groups know nothing about these matters. The conspiracy theorists are all wrong about how things are controlled. Masons, virtually none of them know about this subject." Bell Ives knew little beyond what I told him. And he was a 32nd degree Mason. But there are always a few who do know, and it is their role to go to their peerage, because they have their trust and their respect, and say, "None of this could be true, and you can trust me. I'm your buddy. I'm one of you." It's the country club mentality. They belong to the same peerage, and they're people of stature, but in reality such figures are on the payroll as assets of this shadowy group. That is how the secrecy is maintained. It's actually very simple. And it's nowhere near as conspiratorial as many people would suppose. You don't need many of these control points if they're people of stature and have high credibility and visibility. All they need to do is say, "None of this is true, and if it were true, you know I would tell you." Right. That the government at this point, "I know we have been investigating since 1947 has not come up with an answer," to me indicates that there is something seriously wrong. Are we this incompetent in science? I don't think so. Are we this incompetent in intelligence? I know we are not this incompetent in intelligence. Now, Project Blue Book, when it was closed by Dr. Condon's group, I have every reason to believe that this was a total deliberate whitewash. UFOs have been investigated for an extended period of time and the general public is not being made aware, fully aware, but are given only bits and pieces, programmed responses and things like that. Master Sergeant Dan Morris, U.S. Air Force, NRO operative, I became part of a group that would investigate, gather the information, and in the beginning it was still under the Blue Book, Snowbird and different covert programs. I would go interview people who claimed they had seen something and try to convince them they hadn't seen something or that they were hallucinating. Well, if that didn't work, another team would come in and give all the threats. And threaten them and their family and so on and so forth. And they would be in charge of discrediting them, making them look foolish and so on and so forth. Now if that didn't work, then there was another team that put an end to that problem, one way or another. Dr. Robert Wood, McDonnell Douglas Aerospace Engineer, as you may know. When you get cleared for one of these classified programs, you wear your special badge and you know you can talk to anybody who's in the room with a lot of candor and it feels like that's one's psychological group. There's a lot of camaraderie that builds up, and you had access to special libraries. So one of the things that we could do is go up to the library that the Air Force ran and sort of pour through top secret material. Since I was interested in UFOs, when I had some usual business to take care of, I'd also look in their library to see what they had on UFOs. And for about a year one was getting quite a few hits on the subject about various reports. Then all of a sudden, the whole subject material vanished. The entire classification for the subject just vanished. The librarian in our group that I was working with said he'd been in that vault for 20 years and knew exactly how things were normally done. He said, "This is remarkable." He said, "I've never seen that before, you just don't have a whole subject vanish out from under you." He said, "I think there is something there that you hit on." In the meantime, there was one other thing that came about as a result of my association with Jim McDonald. I liked the guy. He was really an energetic physicist and wouldn't let any grass grow under his feet. When he got a case, he would dig his teeth into it and present an overwhelmingly convincing story to professional societies. He would talk to the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics and the American Physical Society, and I happened to be members of both. So whenever he was in town I would pick him up, escort him, made sure he felt welcome. So once when I was traveling through Tucson, where he lived, I stopped, I had a 2-hour layover to catch an airplane, and he came out to the airport to have a beer with me. I said, "What's new, Jim?" He said, "I think I've got it." I said, "What do you think you got?" He said, "I think I got the answer." I said, "What is it?" He said, "I can't tell you yet. I have got to be sure." It was 6 weeks after that he tried to shoot himself. A couple months after that he finally died. Knowing what I think I now suspect about the skills of our counter-intelligence people, I think we had the capacity to convince him to do it himself. I think that's what happened. Clearly, in order to have effective control of this subject, you have to control it at all levels, and the most obvious level is the media. So you have to look at all the kinds of media there are, the movies, the magazines, and of course in the early days that's all it is, newspapers and movies and magazines. Now we have the internet and video and all those other sorts of things. But as the technology has blossomed in these other avenues, the people worrying about this control have also just moved into those avenues right along with them. So every time a new avenue comes up they have a new counterpoint. Dr. Paul Zeiss, McDonnell Douglas career engineer. The black budget world is like trying to describe Casper the Friend, the ghost. You might see a cartoon of him but you don't know how big he is, you don't know where his funding comes from. You don't know how many there are because of the compartmentalization and the oath that people have to take. I know people today that worked on one of the things that I worked on, and if you asked them about it, even if it is being discussed on the internet, they would say no, I have no idea what you're talking about. They're in their 70s now, but they still absolutely would never admit that they even know what you're talking about. You have no idea, but it's probably larger than you think. John Callahan, far head of accidents and investigations, when they got done, they actually swore all these other guys in there that this UFO event never took place. We never had this meeting. And this was never recorded. This was one of the guys from the CIA. Okay? That they were never there and this never happened. At the time I said, "Well, I don't know why you are saying this. I mean, there was something there and if it's not the stealth bomber, then you know, it's a UFO. And if it's a UFO, why wouldn't you want the people to know?" Oh, they got all excited over that. "You don't even want to say those words." He said this is the first time they ever had 30 minutes of radar data on a UFO. And they are all itching to get their hands onto the data and to find out what it is and what really goes on. He says if they come out and told the American public that they ran into a UFO out there, it would cause panic across the country. So therefore, you can't talk about it. And they are going to take all this data. When the CIA told us that this never happened and we never had this meeting, I believe it was because they didn't want the public to know that this was going on. Normally we would put out some type of a news release that such and such happened. Well, I've been involved in a lot of cover-ups with the FAR. When we gave the presentation to the Reagan staff I was behind the group that was there. And when they were speaking to the people in the room, they had all those people swear that this never happened. Professor Robert Jacobs, US Air Force, after an article came out about the UFO incident, the shit hit the fan. I started being harassed at work. I started getting odd telephone calls that would come during the day. At night, at my house I would get telephone calls, all night long, sometimes 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, midnight, 10 o'clock, people would call and start screaming at me. "You are going down, motherfucker. You are going down, motherfucker." And that's all they would say. And they'd keep screaming that until I finally hung up the phone. One night somebody blew up my mailbox by putting a big load of skyrockets in it. The mailbox went up in flames. And that night at 1 o'clock in the morning the phone rang. I picked it up and somebody said, "Skyrockets in your box at night, Oh, what a beautiful sight, motherfucker. And things like that have happened on and off since 1982. I believe this nutty fringe around UFOs is part of a concerted effort to keep serious study of it down. Anytime anybody tries to study this subject seriously, we are subject to ridicule. I'm a full professor at a relatively major university. And I'm certain that my colleagues at the university laugh at me and hoot and holler behind my back when they hear that I have an interest in studying unidentified flying objects. And that's just one of the things that we have to live with. What happened to the Air Force UFO film is an interesting story in itself, as Major Mansman related to me and other people. Sometime after I had gone, the guys in civilian clothes, I thought it was the CIA, but he said no, it wasn't the CIA, it was somebody else. Took the film and they spooled off the part that had the UFO on it, and they took a pair of scissors and cut it off. They put that on a separate reel. They put it in their briefcase. They handed Major Mansman back the rest of the film and said, "Here, I don't need to remind you, Major, of the severity of a security breach. We'll consider this incident closed." And they walked off with the film. Major Mansman never saw it again. Radar and Pilot Cases, J.C., Chief John Callahan S.G., Dr. Stephen Greer J.C. Now in the 747 they have radar in the nose that picks up the weather outside there. So his radar is picking up a target. He sees this target with his eyes. And the target, the way he described it, was a huge ball with lights running around it. And I think he said it was like four times as big as a 747. And the military man said something like, "Yeah, I see him 35 miles north of Anchorage. The UFO was bouncing around the 747 here." And when he would say that, the military guy would cut in and say, "He's now at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock and he would confirm the position. The military controller has what they call height finding radar, and they have long range radar and short range radar. So if they don't catch it on one of their systems, they catch it on the other." And if you listen to the military man, at one time he said, "I have it on the height radar, or my range radar," which indicated that they had a target on his system. Well, they ran through for the best part of 31 minutes. Then the next day I got a call from someone with the scientific study group, for President Reagan, or the CIA, I'm not sure who it was, the first call. And they had some questions about the incident. And I had said, "I don't know what you are talking about, you probably want to call the Admiral, through Administrator Engine." Well, a few minutes later the Admiral calls down and says, "I have set up a briefing tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock a.m. in the round room. Bring all the stuff you have. Bring everybody up there and give them whatever they want. We want to get out of it. Just let them do whatever they want." So I brought all the people from the tech center. We had all kinds of boxes of data that we had them print out. It filled up the room. They brought in three people from the FBI, three people from the CIA, and three people from Reagan's scientific study team. I don't know who the rest of the people were, but they were all excited. When they got done, they actually swore all these other guys in there that this never took place. We never had this meeting. And this was never recorded. The only ones that see a UFO in the TV programs are the rednecks out in the country that are going coon hunting or alligator hunting at night. You don't find anybody with any kind of smarts or some professional individual saying, "Hey, last night let me tell you what I saw." They don't display that in the United States. So if you talk about seeing a UFO, you are putting yourself in a funny kind of category. That's probably one of the reasons why you don't hear about it anymore. But as far as I'm concerned, I saw a UFO chase a Japanese 747 across the sky for over half an hour on radar. And it's faster than anything that I know of in our government. It still bothers me that I've seen all this, I know all this, and I'm walking around with the answer, and nobody wants to ask the question to get the answer. And it kind of irritates me a little bit. And I don't believe our government should be set up that way. I think when we have something like this, that you can probably find out more about what's going on in the world by not covering it up. If they, the UFOs, can travel that far, that distance with that type of machinery, who knows what they could do here for the health of the nation, the people, the food they could give them, the cancers we could cure. They have to know more than us to be able to travel at that speed. For those people that say that if these UFOs existed, they would someday be on radar and that there'd be professionals who would see it, then I can tell them that back in 1986 there were enough professional people that saw it. It was brought down to headquarters, FAR headquarters, Washington DC. The administrator saw the tape of it. The people that we were debriefing, they've all seen. Reagan's scientific study team, three of those professors, doctors, they've seen it. As far as I was concerned, they were the ones that verified my own thoughts about it. They were very, very excited about the data. They had said that this was the only time a UFO was ever recorded on radar for any length of time where it is 30-some minutes. And they have all this data to look at. What I can tell you is what I've seen with my own eyes. I've got a videotape. I've got the voice tape. I've got the reports that were filed that will confirm what I've been telling you. And I'm one of those, what you would call the high government officials in the FAR. I was a division chief. I was only 3 or 4 down from the Admiral SAC/Nuke Lieutenant Colonel Bob Sallers. The UFO incident happened on the morning of March 16, 1967. I was on duty along with my commander Fred Meyerwald. We were both on duty at Oscar Flight as part of the 490th Strategic Missile Squadron. There are 5 launch control facilities assigned to that particular squadron. We were at Oscar Flight. It was still dark out and we're 60 feet underground, at the ICBM launch control facility. It was early in the morning and I received a call from my topside security guard, who's the flight security controller, and he said that he and some of the guards had been observing some strange lights flying around the site around the launch control facility. He said they were acting very unusual, just flying around. And I said, "You mean UFO?" He said, "Well, he didn't know what they were, but they were lights and were flying around. They were not airplanes. They weren't making any noise. They were not helicopters. They were making some very strange maneuvers and he couldn't explain it." It wasn't more than a few minutes, maybe a half hour later, and he calls back, and this time he's very frightened. I can tell by the tone of his voice he's very shook up. He says, "Sir, there's a glowing red object hovering right outside the front gate. I'm looking at it right now. I've got all the men out here with their weapons drawn." I immediately went over to my commander, who was taking a nap. We have a little cot down there for rest periods, and I was telling him about the telephone call we just received. As I was relating this to him, our missiles started shutting down one by one. By shutting down, I mean they went into a no-go condition, meaning they could not be launched. So we get bells and whistles, a red light no-go condition. These weapons were Minuteman I missiles and were of course nuclear-tipped warhead missiles. As they started shutting down, immediately he gets up and we both start querying the status board. We've got the ability to query and deter, mine what the cause of the shutdowns was. As I recall, most of them were guidance and control system failures. And then he started reporting to the command post. In the meantime, I called upstairs to find out what the status was of this object, and the guard said, "Well, the object has left, it just left at high speed." The Air Force did an extensive investigation of the entire incident and was not able to come up with a probable cause for the shutdowns. And I've got quite a few witnesses that will testify to that. We've got a couple of people who worked on the investigative team, and I've got correspondence from the man who actually organized the investigative team. There was no viable explanation for this shutdown of multiple ICBMs. Each missile is basically self-supporting. Most of them are powered by commercial power, but each missile has its own power generator. At our site, anywhere from 6 to 8 went down, but they went down in rapid succession, which again is an extremely rare happening. We rarely had more than one missile go down for any reason at all. After I talked to my guard upstairs, my commander talked to the command post. When he finished talking to the command post, he turned to me and said, "The same thing occurred at Echo Flight."